Evasions. Boston, March 2020. The ride roughened as the car rolled to a stop by the side of the road. Rita heard voices, muffled through the carpet. A door opened, then slammed. Footsteps on gravel coming round the trunk. Okay, they figured it out. She tensed. Click. The trunk unlocked, and the lid began to rise. Rita bounced upright, uncoiling like a jack-in-the-box, and slammed the wrench right to left along the length of the gap, two-handed. The impact nearly yanked it from her grip. Someone gasped, trying to inhale. She shouldered the tailgate open and lunged from the trunk, landed sprawling on top of a man who was trying to lever himself upright. She heard the warble and scream of sirens in the distance. Dry-mouthed terror lent her strength as she whacked the wrench into the side of his head, rolled off him, and came up in a crouch. Some subtle cue made her duck and spin. The fist that had been aiming for her face missed. She continued her turn and jabbed with the wrench. Her second assailant was a shadowy silhouette, backlit by the dim blue LED glow of the streetlights. He was taller and heavier than she was, and fast enough to dodge her inexpert attempt at punching him in the gut. She took a long stride backward, keeping the wrench extended, then another, trying to open a gap. Long-ago classes in karate and Krav Maga, and less long-ago women's self-defense courses, had stressed the importance of not letting a big aggressor get within arm's reach. The one she'd put down wasn't moving, but his friend was following her warily, reaching for, "Oh, shit!" Rita spun and ran, jinking sideways. The taser dart whipped past her on its crackling tether. There was no traffic and no lit windows on this stretch of all but deserted highway, just shuttered exhaust shops and landscaping services. She made for the slope at the side of the road, looking for a gap between bushes and fences. Her phone buzzed in her pocket like a box of angry bees, but she ignored it. Then there were footsteps behind her. She was fast, and he'd paused to ditch the taser, but if he caught up with her, this could only end badly. And if he didn't chase her but had a real gun, he'd eventually get hyped up enough to use it. The sirens, still distant, were fading now. She found a gap, a driveway leading into a row of closed shop units, and dashed through it. There was a whining noise overhead, and a pool of blindingly white light appeared around her. She threw up one arm to shield her eyes as an alarm began to beep frenetically. She heard a flat crack of gunshots, two, three, as she dove for the side of the nearest shop, trying to get out of view. The whine rose to a metallic screech above her, then cut off, followed half a second later by a tearing crash as something refrigerator-sized fell in the parking lot behind her. There was another volley of gunshots, then a roar of engine noise, and a stentorian amplified voice commanding her to freeze. Rita lay face down, shaking with fear. Her kidnapper had a gun. She could see him silhouetted in the light from the second drone, this one keeping a healthy distance overhead. He raised it, fired twice more, then swept round toward a target she couldn't see. Two more shots rang out, not his. He dropped where he stood, like a marionette with cut strings. The amplified voice kept bellowing at him to lie still, long after it was obvious he was beyond hearing. And her phone was still buzzing when the first cop, a for-real highway patrol officer, advancing in swivel-eyed starts with pistol drawn, reached her and put the cuffs on. Frying pan, meat, fire. Shock can affect short-term memory. Rita retained only fragments of the next half hour, sitting in the back of a parked police cruiser with her hands zip-tied behind her back. She saw more cruisers with light bars flaring against the night, converging on the parking lot. There were a few terse questions. Name, what was she doing here? Repeated in tones of angry disbelief, when she explained she'd been carjacked and had escaped. Someone took her emergency phone. Kidnappees were not supposed to escape, she gathered. Someone else asked her to identify her handbag, her phone. More questions. What was she doing? Where had she been? Had she seen her assailants? Why are you lying to us? While they were asking, her fat phone vibrated for attention. One of the officers answered it, asking a couple of brusque questions. Then his manner changed completely. "Aw, shit," he said. "Okay, we'll wait here." He ended the call. "Did you get the ID to match?" he asked his partner. "Yup." The partner in question eyeballed Rita in the rear view. "Name check is... Hey, listen up!" The cop cranked his head round to look at Rita. "Your friends want you out of here. They'll be here in 10 minutes. "What friends?" she asked, but they had no answer for her. A gathering dust storm and the thunder of full-sized rotor blades brought Rita back from the dark place. She looked up dully, squinting puffy red-rimmed eyes against the wind blast through the open front windows of the car. She'd been scared sick before, wondering how she was going to make bail. They'd find something to charge her with just for inconveniencing them. That's how it worked, wasn't it? But now something worse was descending, gravid with dark possibilities. The chopper touched down at the far end of the parking lot. To her uneducated eye, it looked huge and menacing, studded with doors and odd protuberances. In fact, it was a regular police Black Hawk, an ex-military transport chopper rigged for urban search operations, with cameras and satellite drones to augment its cyclopean searchlight stare. The side doors opened and two men and a woman climbed out, ducking involuntarily beneath the swoosh of the slowing blades overhead. After a brief conference with the officers clustered around the incident control van, one of the men peeled off and walked toward the cruiser. As if it was a prearranged signal, the driver up front climbed out, walked round to the passenger door, and casually tugged her to get her moving. "Get the ties off her," said Jack, holding an ID badge where the uniforms could see it. He sounded disgusted. "Is this some kind of masshole thing, or do you always arrest kidnap victims?" "Wait, she's a suspect, pending identification. We caught her hanging around..." "Yeah, right. Who do you think phoned in the incident?" He slid his badge away before Rita could read it. The cop ducked his head, unusually compliant, and stepped behind her. Jack moved to face her. "Unless you object, I'm going to take you into protective custody. We can start you on witness security tomorrow. Right now, it's probably too dangerous for you to go home." Rita finally found her voice as her wrists came free. "What the fuck is this about?" Her voice rose. "You set me up, didn't you? You and Gomez." "Hey, calm down." Jack stepped close, lowering his voice. "We didn't know they'd move this fast. Just plain lucky I was on a direct flight right after you. We didn't expect anything like this. Not so soon."
"Like what?"
Rita pointed to the taped-off area, now crawling with cops, both the uniformed kind and crime scene officers in overalls.
"Who are they and what are they doing?"
"I'm not sure."
Jack looked uncomfortable. "Walk with me." He turned toward the helicopter and Rita followed, uncertainly. One of the cops trailed after them with her handbag and suitcase.
"If I had to guess, I'd say they work for a faction opposed to your, DNA donor. Your birth mother."
"My... why?"
"Isn't it obvious? The World Walkers want you dead, Miss Douglas. We got a lead on them, chatter on some of their channels, and ran ahead of it. Luckily for you, as it turns out. If you're asking why they want you dead, well, I'm sorry, but we don't read minds. On the other hand, we're not in the business of letting terrorists murder our people, and you're our best lead on them. This just confirmed they're serious about you. so we're going to try and keep you alive and try to catch the bad guys and discover where they're coming from. Then we're going to deal with them."
It was all too fast and too slick, moving like a Hollywood production on well-greased runners. Rita was tired and hungry and shaking with cold sweat fear, and still she didn't believe him. "But they—"
She stopped, her inner censor clamping down.
"Could have grabbed me and carried me to another world, then cut my throat," she realized. "Why didn't they do that?"
"They employ ordinary criminals to do their legwork," Jack continued. "Those guys were just hired muscle. You managed to bail before they made it to their handover point. But we'd better get you to a safe house before they try again. What do you say?"
I... She trailed off, nodding. "Yeah. Yeah, whatever you say." What she really wanted to do was to phone Mom and Dad, reassure them that she was okay, then go and hide under the bed or take a long bath and not leave her home for a week. But her comfort zone seemed as far away as Pluto. "Whatever you think," she said, surrendering to the inevitable. "Just get me out of here."
"Deal," said Jack.
He held the helicopter door open for her. It felt curiously flimsy after the trunk lid of her car.
"Let's fly. My boss wants to talk to you tomorrow. I think you'll find what he has to say interesting."
Baltimore, March 2020. Federal employee 00493031, classified voice transcript, Dr. Scranton.
"Well, what a mess."
Agent Gomez.
"I knew we should have fridged her adopters instead."
Colonel Smith.
"And I remind you, we don't do that sort of thing these days."
Dr. Scranton.
"Please don't squabble.
It's giving me a headache. I've got to work out what kind of spin to put on this. It's not a matter of shoving it under the carpet. There isn't enough carpet in Persia to cover up this mess."
Agent Gomez.
"The hired help were deniable assets."
Dr. Scranton.
"And may I remind you, the Massachusetts State Highway Patrol, the Boston PD, the local branch of the FBI, a bunch of hick security goons from Dorchester, and probably the MIT campus police and the marching band of the Massachusetts Rotary Club all got a slice of this cake? The folks upstairs are going to have a fit trying to keep the lid on it tomorrow. And guess who's going to have to brief them? So you people are going to help me assemble a story, a narrative that holds water, and explain just what we were trying to achieve and why this happened. And you'd better hope I can spin it convincingly, because it's not just my job that's on the line if we get it wrong."
Colonel Smith.
"Right. So how about we run through the facts one more time?"
Agent Gomez.
"Go for it."
Colonel Smith.
"I'll start. Subject, Rita Douglas. It was decided..."
Agent Gomez.
"By this team collectively, let's get that clear."
Colonel Smith.
"Shut up. It was decided by this team that in order to expedite the voluntary recruitment of the candidate, we should subject Rita Douglas to a motivational scenario. Frightening, but basically harmless."
Dr. Scranton.
"Only it turned out she had bigger balls than expected."
Colonel Smith.
"A pair of stringers were commissioned via a blind cutout to conduct the exercise. Small-time thugs. There's no back trail to us that doesn't equally plausibly point at the adversaries."
Agent Gomez.
"Hell, it's the sort of thing they do. We just stole a leaf from their playbook. If they'd identified her themselves, they'd probably have done it for us."
Colonel Smith.
"Don't interrupt. Your concerns are noted and will be taken into account. Let me remind everyone who we're dealing with here. Miriam Beckstein's daughter."
Agent O'Neill.
"Who was raised by total strangers, is an inactive carrier of the world-walking trait, and who is a Generation Z underachiever who works as a booth babe at trade shows."
Colonel Smith.
"But who, despite being tased and shoved in a trunk, correctly evaluated her situation and turned the tables on her kidnappers. She did serious physical damage to one of them, subdural hematoma, and major abdominal bruising. His condition is listed as critical by Mass General, by the way.
Dr. Scranton. Where did she get the blackjack?
Agent Gomez. It wasn't a blackjack, it was a tire iron. And she had it in her car trunk, under the carpet where the muscle didn't spot it.
Dr. Scranton.
Lovely. Do please continue, Colonel.
Colonel Smith.
She called the cops. Why did it get through? I thought we had a divert on her phone.
Agent O'Neill.
We did indeed have a divert. It didn't work. Turns out the hired goons took her handbag and phone off her. They weren't idiots, and somebody forgot to hand them that part of the script. Turns out she had a survival kit in the trunk. Blankets, first aid kit, tire iron, and a prepaid phone for emergencies. And nobody thought to search her car before she got to it, so we never found it.
Agent Gomez. If we're parceling out the blame, I'd just like to note Dr. Scranton.
Don't bother.
I'm not going to let this turn into a scapegoating exercise. Just stick to the story so that I know what I'm covering for.
Agent O'Neill. She took down one goon and ran for it. Then, because she got through to the real 911 service, the state police dogpiled the scene, which made Goon 2 lose his shit and light up one of their drones, and it went downhill from there.
Dr. Scranton. So we can point to the goon going off script by taking her bag and her unusual degree of preparedness in having an emergency kit in her trunk. So my next question is, did she swallow the narrative? Have we spoiled her by accident? It'd be a real shame if all this mess was for nothing.
Colonel Smith. That's a good question. I don't think we're going to learn the answer to it until I've had a chance to talk to her myself later today.
Agent O'Neill.
I make it 50-50. If she buys it, we might be able to recover and acquire a useful asset. I mean, she showed initiative and courage under pressure. That's got to be a plus. But if she doesn't buy the scenario...
Dr. Scranton.
We'll worry about how deep to bury her if and when that eventuates. Hopefully it won't. Meanwhile, I call this a wrap. Let's go and get some sleep. Tomorrow morning I'll brief the folks upstairs. In the meantime, when Rita's had a bit of time to think about things, Sonia and Patrick can take her in and Eric can pitch her the offer. We'll take it from there.
End transcript. Boston, March 2020. The helicopter spirited her away into night and mist. After a flight lasting less than 30 minutes, it landed in a distant corner of an airfield, where the gray shadows of military transport aircraft lined the runway. Jack led her to a van with blacked-out windows, and it took them to a hangar. Then he led her inside, to a corner where a stack of modular prefab offices formed a multi-story complex, completely invisible to the outside world. One of these was tricked out with another bland motel-style room with no windows and no handle on the inside of the door. Rita was unsure whether or not to feel grateful for the locks and the dog-sized six-legged robots with grenade launchers patrolling the darkness outside. She was beginning to suspect that perhaps the only foolproof way to tell the difference between a fortress and a jail was by the attitude of the guards to the inmates. She held herself together while she showered and unpacked enough of her personal effects to pretend that this room was yet another hotel suite, rather than a fancy prison. But then the day's events hit home. Curling up beneath the comforter, she clutched her phone, her traitorous link to the world, and hit up the local news sites, mindful that everything she surfed would be as transparent as glass to her custodians. There was, she discovered, absolutely no word of a lethal shootout near the interstate south of Boston. Nothing. She hadn't been expecting to be the talk of the town, but the totality of the media blackout was chilling. Everybody understood that this sort of thing happened, that the First Amendment had to take a backseat to the requirements of national security from time to time.
but witnessing the thoroughness with which everything from street cams through Twitter feeds fell silent before the demands of the dark state gave her an eerie sense of detachment. It was as if she was coming adrift from her life, and all that was solid was melting into air. She began to shake. Then the tears came. Catharsis and sleep brought her to a better place by the time she woke, early the next morning. The lack of manacles and orange jumpsuits was a positive sign. Her absent relatives might be enemies of the state, but the state had decided that she was not one of them. She forced herself to message her parents, flatmates, and a handful of friends, telling them she'd been delayed out west, but was okay. She kept it to the sort of content-free fluff that would tell a censor nothing about her, and that might even be viewed as evidence of cooperation. By the time there was a knock on the door, she thought she'd managed to compose herself. But she learned she was wrong the hard way, as her heart pounded wildly. "Come in," she said, as if her consent meant anything. The door opened. It was Gomez, her gaze as judgmental as before. "Get your stuff together, you're coming with me," she said. "5 minutes." Then she stood just inside the entrance at parade rest, watching as Rita hastily flung her toothbrush and spare clothes into her bag. "Where are we going?" Rita asked. "Breakfast. Then an interview." Gomez spoke as if words came at a price. She led Rita along a narrow corridor, then into a windowless ready room equipped with a metal sink and bare tables, a couple of bagged McDonald's breakfast muffins and oily, bitter cups of coffee awaited. Rita managed to eat under Gomez's stern gaze. "Is it the World Walker thing that bugs her so much?" she wondered. "Or is it my skin?" Maybe the two were too deeply intertwined for Gomez to suspend her prejudice. Rita could have passed for Middle Eastern. And if Gomez saw her as a wanted terrorist's left-behind baggage... Gomez drove her out of the prefab into the overcast morning light, steering an unmarked SUV under manual control. Her manner robotic, she scanned the rearview display constantly. Perhaps she expected to be tailed by terrorists or attacked by world walkers at any moment. She drove past a taxiway and a ramp studded with parked blue-gray drones, then hung a right into a tightly spiraling underpass, leading to an underground parking lot. At the bottom, a security booth and barrier blocked her path. She halted, wound the window down, and presented an ID card to a uniformed security guard. The guard peered at the badge, then at Gomez, then stared at Rita, huddling in the passenger seat.
"ID, please."
"Agent Gomez with candidate Red," she told him. "Candidate has no ID but should be on your list. I'm signing for her on my cognizance."
"Yes, ma'am."
He eyeballed Rita again, comparing her with an image on his glasses.
"Look directly at me, ma'am."
Rita looked. Saw a Homeland Security uniform, a sidearm, warning notices, and thumbprint locks on the kiosk behind him.
"Spit here,"
he ordered, proffering a glass tube. Rita spat on demand. Then she and Gomez waited for a couple of minutes as the guard processed the sample.
"You're cleared to proceed."
The barrier rose and the tire-height caltrops retracted into the concrete beneath it.
"Have a good trip, y'all."
"A good...
later."
Gomez's tone was sharp. Another sharply spiraling ramp took them down another level, then another barrier retracted into the ground. Ahead, the ramp funneled them into something like a truck-sized freight elevator. Gomez inched forward, following directions on a large screen at the far side of the elevator car, then switched off the SUV's motor. "You may need to swallow a couple of times to clear your ears," she told Rita as the elevator door rose behind them. "Swallow?" Something flickered behind Rita's eyes, and her inner ears tightened painfully as if she was in a rapidly descending airliner.
What was that?
Gomez said nothing until the elevator door opened again. Then she backed the SUV out into the parking garage. It was brightly lit now. Much too bright. Rita glanced up through the car's glass roof and saw wisps of cirrus drifting across a blue sky overhead. She froze. When they'd driven in, the sky had been slate gray with heavy cloud. "Welcome to Timeline 4," Gomez said dryly. "Ever wondered if a new life awaits you in the off-world colonies? Because now's your chance for a preview."
Near Boston, Timeline 4, March 2020. There was no airfield here, no underground parking lot, just a ramp leading down to a half-buried blockhouse surrounded by a razor-wire fence. There was a road, a one-lane blacktop with no sidewalk, a guard checkpoint with cameras, a couple of parked gunbots, and a flagpole flying the stars and stripes. Beyond it, Rita saw nothing but forest. Gomez drove slowly past the checkpoint, then along the road between the trees. "We're still inside the outer perimeter of Camp Graceland," she told Rita, losing some of her chilly reserve. "It goes on for miles."
"We're in another timeline," Rita thought aloud. "That wasn't a freight elevator, was it?"
"Nope." She caught Gomez's withering, sidelong glance and the thought behind it. "Are you really that stupid?"
The world walkers. They don't know about this timeline, do they?"
Now Gomez looked at her properly, a slow, appraising stare that would have made Rita nervous if they'd been driving much faster than the posted 10-mile-per-hour speed limit. The DHS agent looked back at the road.
"Assumptions are dangerous, Ms. Douglas. I could tell you that we don't think the Klan know of this world, and I might believe it too, but that doesn't automatically make it so."
"The Klan? You mean the World Walkers?"
"The Klan is the organization we consider the state's most lethal threat to national security. They're World Walkers, yes."
"But..."
Rita checked her assumptions. What she knew about World Walkers was drawn from the news media, and as Kurt had carefully taught her to see, the news media were often deliberately misleading.
"You mean there's more than one kind?"
"Do bears do their business in the woods?"
Gomez glanced at her again, then back to the road. It curved around a thick stand of trees, roots forcing the asphalt up into wrinkles on one side. A fork came into view and Gomez turned left. A minute later, they arrived at a broad clearing where a windowless metal and concrete building squatted in the middle of a clear-cut apron. Something buzzed in the distance, like a lawnmower or a weed whacker. Gomez parked between a Jeep Wrangler and a late-model Humvee, then opened her door.
"End of the road, girl. Out and walk."
Somehow that one belittling word rankled, hurting more than all the fear and craziness of the past couple of days. Rita kept her face impassive as she climbed out and collected her bag from the back seat.
"Why did you bring me here?"
"There's a man who wants to see you."
"What about? You bugged my phone. You already know everything that happened to me yesterday.
Job interview, Ms. Douglas. Unless you want to go back to a 0 hours contract for a failing games SFX startup with the Klan looking for you."
Rita stopped mid-stride. "You have got to be kidding."
"The U.S. government does not joke, Ms. Douglas."
Gomez's eyes narrowed. She carried on walking.
"This is the best offer you're going to get. If it was up to me... Come on, let's get this over with."
The front door of the building opened onto a very unwelcoming vestibule, watched over by cameras in armored mountings. The inner door was positioned on one side,
out of direct line of sight of the outer door, and clearly armored. Gomez had Rita stand on a pair of painted yellow footprints so she could look at one of the cameras, while she called someone on her glasses. What unnerved Rita most was the lack of visible guards. Guards meant human interaction. Narrow slots in the walls and ceiling meant something much less pleasant. Bullets or gas. After a nerve-wracking wait, a concealed loudspeaker crackled.
Rita Douglas and Sonia Gomez, you may now enter the secure zone. Please proceed to briefing room G11. Ms. Douglas, do not step across any red lines you see painted on the floor. Use of lethal force is mandated.
Gomez led Rita through a guard room staffed by four soldiers in body armor, who watched them unblinkingly. Then came a door that led into a much more normal office suite. More doors blurred past until they came to G11. Gomez opened it without knocking.
Rita Douglas.
The man behind the desk stood, crow's feet wrinkles around his eyes, and a salesman's outstretched handshake welcomed her. He looked about 50, physically fit but balding, and wore an open-collared dress shirt with his suit.
Have a seat, please. Sonia, if you'd like to wait elsewhere while I discuss the situation with Ms. Douglas.
Gomez virtually jumped to attention, then fled hastily. Rita looked around, perplexed. Apart from the lack of windows, it could have been just another slightly dingy government office, cheap carpet, institutional desk, and a flag in the corner of the room. There was absolutely nothing to show that it was part of an ultra-secure secret compound in another timeline. Rita was beyond diplomacy.
"Who are you people and what do you want with me?" she asked, trying to ignore the slushy fear in her belly. "Why am I here?"
"Sit down."
He didn't sound annoyed exactly, but Rita suddenly found herself sitting in a visitor's chair that was slightly too soft and slightly too low.
"That's better. Can I offer you a coffee? With or without caffeine? This is going to take an hour or two, so you might as well be comfortable."
A couple of minutes later, the door opened again. It was one of the guards, bearing a cardboard coffee cup and a breakfast muffin. Just for her, apparently.
"You can call me Eric," he told her, smiling diffidently. "I also answer to Colonel Smith. But that was in another land and long ago. I'm now officially retired from the Air Force."
His smile faded slightly.
"You're here because you came to our attention before the Klan managed to abduct you, which was lucky, because if things hadn't happened in that order, you'd most likely be dead, and if not dead, you'd be in their hands. The questions you probably have are, why did that happen, and how can I stop it happening again, am I right?"
Rita nodded. "I was told, I was given the impression that you think my birth mother may have something to do with it." Eric looked at her with disconcertingly bright eyes. He seemed to be about the same age as her father, she realized, but had the demeanor of a much younger man, full of a dangerous energy.
"Yes. We've been monitoring you since you were 8, he added, then waited for her to react.
The enormity of it refused to sink in. Why would the DHS monitor an 8-year-old? It seemed flatly implausible, beyond even the paranoia of the bizarro world she'd glimpsed through Gramps's rambling tales of East Germany. "This is about my birth mother, isn't it?" she asked. "Gomez and Jack said she was adopted too," she remembered with a pang. It was an annoyingly humanizing fact, the first hint of a human face behind a silhouette she'd been trying to ignore all her life. She didn't like it. "Why? Did you think she'd show up again after all these years? Like a wicked fairy in one of the Grimm's tales, come to steal me back?"
Eric shook his head. "Nothing so simple."
He put his coffee cup down, then picked up a hand exerciser ball.
What do you know about World Walkers?
What everybody knows? They blew up the White House? They're out there somewhere in the multiverse? And unlike us, they don't need machines to move between other timelines?
Everyone knew a bit about Paratime after the bombing. They'd discovered their enemy had come from another version of this world, where history had diverged from ours. There were an infinite number of such timelines out there. The U.S. had machines that could transport both people and machinery between universes. But it was irrelevant to everyday life, unless you had the bad luck to be caught in the blast radius of a terrorist nuke, planted by bombers from another timeline, or had relatives who had been in India or Pakistan during World War 2.5. All you really needed to know was that they were the enemy, and that overthinking things aloud in public was a bad idea. Yes, I get that one of them gave birth to me once upon a time. But I'm not a...
No, Eric agreed. You're not a member of the clan. And I'd like to distinguish between world walkers, people with the inherited ability to think themselves from one timeline to another, and the clan, an organization of people with that ability. Like the difference between ordinary Muslims and members of Al-Qaeda. The important thing is, one of your parents was a member of the clan. That didn't matter until recently, but things have changed.
What kind of things?
She didn't even try to keep the frustration out of her voice. What's this got to do with me? Eric picked up a tablet and began to read.
Let's see. Rita Douglas, age 25. Adopted and raised by Emily and Franz Douglas in Boston and then New Jersey. Attended UMass, a major in history, a minor in drama. Languages, Spanish, some German. Then a succession of dead-end jobs while trying to pay off student loans and build a career in acting.
He smiled at her, a flash of teeth. Obviously he found something amusing in this.
No criminal record. Not so much as a parking ticket.
The smile vanished.
Congratulations. You're very clean. You'd pass a background check for government service with flying colors.
He put the tablet down.
But it never occurred to you to apply. Any particular reason?
What the fuck? Rita stared at the ex-colonel, then used the too-hot container of too-bitter coffee to buy herself a few seconds. I'm not the type, she said cautiously. I'm not interested in the military. She'd heard too many horror stories from Libya and Bangladesh vets. And she'd had friends who'd enlisted, then dropped out of touch. I really wanted to get into a graduate studies history program. Or find a solid stage role, but that's just not happening in this economy. The post-2003 climate wasn't terribly conducive to historical introspection. And as for the stage, a momentary twinge from the implant inside her left elbow reminded her what was wrong with that. What is this about? Why am I here?
You might want to put the coffee down.
She took a mouthful, swallowing hastily and burning the roof of her mouth. Yes? Smith looked straight at her, and she had an uncanny feeling that he could see right through to the back of her skull.
Speculate wildly, please. Why do you think you're here? Why do you think I brought all that stuff up?
I don't know. You're going to offer me a job? Because you've suddenly got a need for world walkers who speak foreign languages and can act? What is this? Mission Impossible? I'm not a spy and I'm not a world walker.
I agree.
The colonel nodded.
You're neither of those things. But we can fix that.
He waited politely for Rita to finish spluttering before he continued.
Here's the proposition. We, by which I mean the organization I work for, you don't get to meet anyone else at this point, are empowered to offer you a job with strings attached. If you take it, you'll spend most of the next 2 years going through induction and training. You'll learn necessary skills to bring you up to speed and be thoroughly evaluated along the way. It'll be a lot like being in the army, but without the uniform, the shouting, the saluting, and the shooting. If you wash out, well, the pay's decent, and maybe you'll take away some useful skills. If you pass but don't have quite the right aptitude, you can quit, or we can find you a job within DHS that's suited to your abilities. Interrogating Latino theatrical troops or something. A safe office job with a pension at the end, if that's what you want. But if you pass and demonstrate the right qualities, then once you're a probationary federal agent, we can talk about the other stuff.
But I'm not a world walker.
Smith smiled at her again, a Cheshire Cat grin that froze her in her seat. Like I said, that can be fixed. He leaned forward. And it's the one sure way you can guarantee that the Klan won't be able to touch you. But it's only going to happen if you accept this job offer and give it your best shot. And maybe not even then. So, what do you say?
In a moment of crystal clarity, Rita realized two things. One very good, and one very bad. It was the best opportunity she'd had in years, if ever. And she wasn't sure she'd be allowed to turn it down. So she licked her suddenly dry lips and gave what seemed to be the only safe answer.
I'd like to see the fine print, please.